Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, folks, the more I work in identifying the magnitude of the problem, the more I look and go, you know, what is it going to take? What is it going to take for people who love liberty, you know, to finally take a stand and say, I'm not going to let this nation fall? And so we got Paul with us. We're going through the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And welcome back, Paul.
Hey, GR. Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, I don't know what to say. I'm just absolutely amazed. Well, I can't say that people aren't getting involved. They're just getting involved in the wrong thing. And we kind of covered from the beginning of the year, we kind of went through these seven paths. You know, what can you do? Don't buy into the political path of the party. The party there's not a party out there right now that's capable of demanding full compliance, because it's not in, they haven't embraced
it. It's not even on their radar, GR.
It's not embraced, is my point. I mean, the closest party to getting to embracing the Constitution would be the Constitution Party. I was thinking, and I've mentioned this in past shows over the past year or so, that maybe the Independent American Party could be that first party. I was trying to create this competition, and unfortunately, the Independent American Party kind of went tango uniform. And so, I don't know. I realize that we can't go down that path. I realize we can't go down the path of the court. We already know that nullification or a convention will have no effect on taking back our government.
Right.
And there's how many people are running with breakneck speed down both of those paths. And it's the same thing with the sovereign. When we look at how many conservatives are going down the wrong path, what's it going to take for them to realize that we have to take a stand on the Constitution and not chase, you know, these unicorns? Anyway, mm-hmm. So we're going to dive into this, because it's kind of long. This is a total of four pages and a little less than that, but this is the amendments to the Articles of Confederation proposed by a grand committee of Congress. Now, if we look at the past, how many is it? A total of eight amendments that had been attempted. This is being the eighth. They identified very specific commerce powers and commercial powers. They identified very specific fundamental roles and responsibilities that they needed to execute that wasn't enumerated in the Articles of Confederation. So they really have come forward and saying, you know, we need to do all of these different things, and we need, you know, to amend the Constitution, states, or we're going to die here.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just listening to you. In this case, we need to enforce the Constitution or we're going to die here.
Well, yeah, but in their case, in their case, it wasn't about enforcing.
Oh, yeah.
In their case, they were going, folks, you know, we need a federal government that can actually provide the services we're asking it to do. We have to empower it to do that.
And they knew that early. Okay. They knew that long before the Constitutional Convention, which we got what we have. It was the basis of, you know, they were challenged by it. They needed something, GR, after once they declared independence.
Right.
But they realized that realized early that something wasn't quite adequate to meet the exigencies. Okay.
There you go.
Of the Union. So, yes, and I guess this document is another example of that, correct?
Right, and actually, when you're looking at it from a macro view, without reading the words, you start noticing that they actually are including brand new articles that they say, we need these powers in addition to what you've already given us. And so, go ahead.
Now I've got a question, and I'm not as familiar with the articles as I am, you know, the Constitution, but apparently they did make amendments to these articles, right?
Right.
Okay. So, and this is the tenor. This is, they're trying to fix this thing, and it's a regular challenge. So
right.
I'm looking forward to learning what they have to say here.
Right, because actually we kind of covered the Commerce Clause and some of the things, and Article 14 dives into this. Now, just remember, when the Constitutional Convention, just like this amendment, when the Constitutional Convention moved forward, there were five plans that were submitted. The first four were rejected. The fifth being the compromise between the existing Virginia plan and other plans was the path chosen. They chose to go with this compromise in maintaining state sovereignty as well as giving people representation. And, you know, so this is what we got is from that compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to be clear, you know, there may have been some desires within Continental Congress. As we read through this, we're going to see that they actually wanted some powers that weren't necessary, that they didn't get in the Constitution. And Article 4 already talks about it. But I just want to be clear that they, when you look at what Continental Congress is doing in these amendments and in adding these articles, it's like they're writing a blank check. You know, if we can have whatever we want, this is what we would really need and what we want. Boom, 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 mm-hmm. boom, boom. And some of these things they legitimately needed, and some of these things, you know, they wanted, but they never got.
Okay.
And that's, I think, the takeaway here. So mm-hmm. with that, go ahead and commence. And it starts,
okay.
It starts off with the grand committee consisting of Mr. Livermore. So
right.
It identifies who's in this. And you will probably notice that the only person that I recognize out of this entire list may be Mr. Pickney.
Okay. All right. The grand committee consisting of Mr. Livermore, Mr. Dane, Mr. Manning, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Smith, Mr. Sims, Mr. Pettit, Mr. Henry, Mr. Lee, Mr. Bloodworth, Mr. Pinckney, and Mr. Houston appointed to report such amendments to the Confederation and such resolutions as it may be necessary to recommend to the several states for the purpose of obtaining from them such powers as will render the federal government adequate to the ends for which it was instituted. Beg leave to submit the following report to the consideration of Congress, resolved that it be recommended to the legislatures of the several states to adopt the following articles as articles of the Confederation and to authorize their delegates in Congress to sign and ratify the same severally as they shall be adopted, to wit. Article 14. The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive power of regulating the trade of the United States trade of the states as well with foreign nations as with each other, and of laying such prohibitions and such imposts and duties upon imports and exports as may be necessary for the purpose.
Okay, so right there, they're asking to be able to regulate trade within the states.
Okay.
Within. They want to regulate the trade of the states as well as with foreign nations, as with each other, as of laying. So in other words, they want to be able to get into the knickers of the states.
Now, yesterday we talked about the Commerce Clause.
Yes, and the Commerce Clause at that point only spoke externally. Now we actually see that the frustration, a year later, the frustration of Continental Congress is, you know what, we not only need, you know, to have more vigorous control over commerce externally, we need to be able to control, because the states were actually doing bypassing. They were creating their own treaties, and they were exporting things out to the world that was undermining the other states.
Mm.
In other words, they were all engaging in this independent, free-willy, you know, trade deals so
right.
that they could actually, you know, get advantages over the other states in what okay. their trades were. So they really looked at this as, hey, bottom line, you know, we need to be able to regulate the trade within the states as well.
And so the way they saw this is that it was undermining the union.
Correct.
Not necessarily that they wanted control of the states, but that the states were acting independently, not with the benefit of the whole union in mind.
Right. So if you go back to 1781, the Second Amendment, one of the very first amendments they asked for were coercive powers. They mm-hmm. wanted to be able to punish the states and the people if they bypassed or violated this Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. But
right.
they never got that. Now, so we may actually see in here an article saying that they get these coercive powers. But the thing is, if the federal government, or I should say the general government, under the Articles of Confederation was granted coercive powers to be able to punish the state when they violated the, you know, trade, in other words, if trade with foreign nations was a something that they could exercise coercive powers over, then they wouldn't need to worry about the exporting of goods, because clearly
right.
the Constitution allowed the states to freely export other than, you know, to foreign nations, but they could freely export to each other.
Right.
And so there was a free trade agreement among the Union, but anything going and coming, they had the authority over, and they had coercive authority to basically step in and stop and say, you can't be doing this. You can't be undermining the Union. It's like it would be unconscionable in their day that they would send arms to a hostile nation.
Ah, right.
Now, sure. let me give you an example. When you look at the military aircraft plants that were mothballed, I believe, in Ohio, and the sale and transfer of those military aircraft plants in the 1990s being authorized to be packed up and shipped to the Chinese Communist Party, that right there was treason.
You know what? I'm from Ohio, and I did not even know that happened.
Oh, yeah. That happened under Clinton's watch. If you look at, as a matter of fact, there's a link on my website that goes through the timeline of how China was paying the Clintons, literally giving him cash for doing things that, you know, benefited them that were absolutely, did not benefit us for security purposes, like, you know, the potential of them taking control of the Panama Canal, the potential mm-hmm. of them taking control of American ports, the potential of them obtaining, you know, this nuclear power technology out of Los Alamos, New
right.
Mexico, where that hard drive ended up disappearing in the hands of that Chinese spy. Or the Loral technology that was handed to the Chinese Communist Party that actually allowed them, because before, in the 1990s, China couldn't hit the broadside of a continent.
Right. They couldn't even get their missiles off the ground.
That's right. And supposedly Clinton said, well, we want them to launch some satellites for us, so we need to give them this technology. How many satellites have they launched for us? And the reality is he used, he basically used this deal to ingratiate himself, and that was outright treason. Outright treason. And this congressional record that was done by, believe it or not, two reporters from guess what network?
I'm not sure.
MSNBC.
I would not have guessed.
You would never have guessed that that liberal progressive network would have done that, that those guys would have ever been employed there. But at that point in time, there was a little more honesty, even though we thought that the media was really progressive. It was Curry and Winterm, MSNBC reporters, that it basically exposed this. They went and presented to Congress a timeline that they uncovered how the Clinton administration was receiving direct payments from China, and upon the receipt of those payments, certain deals were made, or certain deals were made beforehand, and then they got paid.
What were their names again?
Winterm and Curry. Curry and Winterm. It's right there on Reclaiming the Republic. I believe it's on my podcast page. And if you go to the very, very bottom, and you just, there's not a bunch of hoopla there. It just says, right. Hey, you know, here's the congressional record where two reporters basically gave the timeline of how Clinton committed treason.
Wow.
And this was in 1996. 1996. This was precursor to his impeachment. So the question is, why is it that they impeached him over perjury when they had all of this evidence?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with Biden today. Biden, Clinton, Bush, probably the Bushes. I mean, we should have a lot of presidents, dancing at the end of a rope. Mm. And I hate to say it that way, folks, but I believe in, due process. I believe that everybody gets what's coming to them, but the evidence is overwhelming that these men have sold out America. And they've basically been able to personally benefit from doing so.
Mm.
And they're apparently they're above the law, but in a Republican form of government, nobody's above the law.
Right.
If we're following the law, and the only way we're going to follow the law is that we, the people, demand the law be followed. That's what it takes, folks. You have to hold our public servants accountable and demand that they hold each other accountable.
Right.
And that's all done through petition. So anyway, let's go back to where you were, provided the citizens of the states. Go ahead.
Right. We were in Article 14, and I read the first clause.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and such imposts and duties upon imports and exports as may be necessary for the purpose, provided the citizens of the United States shall in no instance be subjected to pay higher duties and imposts than those imposed on the subjects of foreign powers, provided also that all such duties as may be imposed shall be collected under such regulations as the United States and Congress assembled shall establish consistent with the constitutions of the states respectively, and to accrue to the use of the state in which the same shall be payable, provided also that the legislative power of the several states shall not be restrained from laying embargoes in times of scarcity, and provided lastly that every act of Congress for the above purpose shall have the assent of 9 states in Congress assembled, and in that proportion when there shall be more than 13 in the Union.
Okay, so here we go. Looking at how they further qualified that they wanted to regulate commerce within the states, they wanted to make sure that the states didn't. So did they include this in the Constitution? That the states couldn't impose duties that were greater than what was being imposed on foreign nations. In other words, what does the Constitution say about imposts one state to another?
The states are not to do that.
That's right. They are not to do that, but they can charge fees that are reasonable to overcome the costs or the burdens or the wear and tear placed upon the port facility, the roads, or what have you, for the traversing through their state the commerce that's coming from abroad. So, in other words, they're protecting the interior states from being taken advantage of because they right. don't have a seagoing port. So, in other right. words, they actually provided this little bit of regulation within the states in the Constitution, but it's in Article 1, Section 10, not as a power, but as an inhibitor, a restriction.
As a limitation.
Right, correct.
Right.
Okay, so okay. Then we place context to actually Article 14, when it seemed like they wanted carte blanche general powers to regulate the states. Actually, they didn't get it. What they did was they created nugatory powers in Article 1, Section 10.
Right.
That's why their actual power, their positive power, is listed as regulating commerce among the states, not within. Because that's what's in Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress shall have the power to regulate, you know, foreign trade with foreign or trade with foreign nations and among the states, trade among the states and with Indian tribes. So in other words, they have direct positive regulating powers over foreign trade, over Indian trade, and among the states, trade among the states, not within the states, because they've gotten, and this is why we have the petition going after, this is why we have this petition going after them in the Commerce Clause. We kind of lay out how they've used the Commerce Clause as justifications. So, yeah, go ahead. What we'll do is let me get through this, and what we'll do is we'll go into the break and we'll pick this up with Article 15. But what I'm trying to explain, folks, is that the federal government, through the Constitution and through this convention, these men realized that they needed to have some negative powers to make sure that the states didn't behave badly, but they granted themselves very specific powers to keep them from doing so, and so they're not positive powers of being able to come in and dictate that you can't do this. They just wanted to make sure that they couldn't do certain things. In other words, California couldn't create such a burdenous impost. Folks, a tax is a burden. And so when a state comes along and says, we're not accepting your goods unless you do it a certain way, that creates a very onerous burden for a state to manufacture for 49 states, and then for one state out of the union, they have to manufacture a product completely different. That right there is an unreasonable and an unconstitutional burden. There is nothing allowed to allow the states to actually start creating stipulations in how things are to be produced. Not at all. And the fact that the federal government failed to actually support the states when California was so, actually, to be clear, this all comes out in the environmental petition that we're just wrapped up. So, folks, there's going to be a whole bunch of new petitions that are going to be hitting our petition page. We've got a petition coming out on the that's done. It'll be posted on the Commerce Clause. We've got a petition that's going to be posted on the Department of Interior, a petition that will be posted on the Department of Energy, a petition that will be posted on the Environmental Protection Agency. We also have a petition that'll be posted that will actually point out that the federal government has no engineering powers. In other words, they can't, you know, engineer solutions to problems that are not enumerated at all. I mean, it's one thing to engineer solutions to warfare, you know, or for their own purposes of communicating, and, you know, and those types of things that are within their specific realm that is enumerated in that Constitution. So bottom line, when we look at what the federal government is doing here in this article, so we can get back to this because we're going to be going into a break in just a matter of seconds. What I'm trying to tell you folks here is that the Constitution allocated, and what they were asking for was pretty much what they put in. They wanted to make sure that the states could not engage in economic warfare in any fashion or form. So what they were basically putting here actually got included, where the federal government had positive powers of regulating commerce among the states to ensure that they could do that, and why was actually encased in Article 1, Section 10. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I apologize for, I'll just say, going on to ad nauseum regarding this Commerce Clause, but folks, I can't impress upon you enough how the Commerce Clause has been one of the biggest portals for the federal government to assume powers not delegated. So anyway, forgive me, Paul, I hope that you didn't take offense by my tying up the time like that.
Oh, no. Are you kidding? Not at all.
Okay. So, I guess, I mean, you're here to contribute, but sometimes I get embroiled in the point at hand, how important it was. What they were doing here may have come across, and it seemed like they were looking to, and they didn't have a way to frame it because they just put this into an article. But, you know, this is almost the beauty of things. When you really look at everything that they were asking for in the Articles of Confederation and these amendments, it all ended up going into the Constitution. They just didn't create 20 articles. What they did was they created six, and they organized it in fashion. And then in the seventh article, they basically sanctified it by giving the power to the states.
Sure. And as we read through these, we can tell that some of this information is very familiar. You know, some of these things they want is very familiar because they're in the Constitution. And so this information in the article sounds like, oh, I think the realization we have is that when you look back at the history, you realize that from the beginning, they wanted to improve the articles, right?
Right. But you know what? It's not like they were trying to be underhanded. They wanted to give the Continental Congress this magistrate. Remember, I kind of clearly pointed out that the government that they came from was a government that was based on the doctrine of magistrates, that it was kind of a top-down. Mm-hmm. In this case, they tried to make it from a bottom up, but they still maintained a magistrate that had the, you know, in one body, which was Continental Congress, all of the residual power. Mm-hmm. Even though it was kind of creating a bottom up design with enumerated powers, they still had this magistrate configuration or a single government where the executive, judiciary, and legislative was all in one.
Right.
And so this is how in the Constitution they actually improved upon it. And instead of vesting all the power in Congress, they created three branches and they separated the roles and responsibilities just to kind of create checks and balances to make sure the same people that were making the laws weren't going to go out and enforce them, i.e. the president, and go out and, you know, seek justice or rectify problems instead of the legislature, the judiciary. So anyway,
And the other thing is, it became more clear to me. It wasn't clear to me at first because I used to promote the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. But there is the magistrates, if there are any, are the people. Okay, the sovereigns are the people. Okay, and there isn't a magistrate that has all the trappings that the word means in its definition, right?
Right, correct.
Okay.
Okay, so Article 15. Go ahead.
Article 15. That the respective states may be induced to perform the several duties mutually and solemnly agreed to be performed by the federal compact, and to prevent unreasonable delays in any state in furnishing her just proportion of the common charges of the Union when called upon, and those essential evils which have heretofore often arisen to the Confederacy from such delays, it is agreed that whenever a requisition shall be made by Congress upon the several states on the principles of the Confederation for the quotas of the common charges or land forces of the Union, Congress shall fix the proper periods when the state shall pass legislative acts complying therewith and give full and complete effect to the same. And if any state shall neglect seasonably to pass such acts, such state shall be charged with an additional sum to her quota called for from the time she may be required to pay or furnish the same, which additional sum or charge shall be at the rate of 10% per annum on her said quota. And if the requisition shall be for land forces, and any state shall neglect to furnish her quota in time, the average expense of such quota shall be ascertained by Congress, and such state shall be charged therewith, or with the average expense of what she may be deficient, and in addition thereto, from the time her forces were required to be ready to act in the field, with a farther sum, which sum shall be at the rate of 12% per annum on the amount of each experience. Now, GR, this sounds like it's one sentence. Okay, that's my first observation here.
Uh-huh.
There weren't even that many commas to take a breath. But
right.
One, this is one sentence, and two, surprising to me, I understand what they're saying here.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear. They have. I do have one question, and that is, let's see, it's that the states shall be, now, it says the state seasonably shall pass such acts, such state. So I think such acts are acts which means by this act, we're going to pay our taxes to the federal government. That's what it sounds like it means, right?
Yeah, so this is literally going back to the coercive powers.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they want, when they tax, they want to be able to come after you and have a mechanism of punishing states for failing to actually provide, you know, the payments on time.
Right.
In other words, if you don't pay, then we're going to charge you interest.
Okay.
And, you know, and then, well, they don't add any additional powers. But bottom line, when we look at the federal, or I should say the U.S. Constitution, had a state gone down the path of saying, we're not paying you anymore, then at that point, unless the state secedes from the Union, mm-hmm. I believe the president then has the ability to ask Congress to basically federalize the militia to go in and arrest these political leaders in that state.
Wow.
Because if they're failing to do what the Constitution demands, then what is the enforcement of that?
Well, they're violating their oath.
Well, so the first step is to basically hit them with, you know, because, okay, you don't have the money.
Okay.
But so what ends up happening when a corporation or some entity goes into bankruptcy? They're unable to actually pay their, you know, their dues, their debt, what have you.
Well, sure. Then their assets are sold.
Well, what happens is they go into conservatorship.
Okay.
And conservatorship actually brings in this third party, or in this particular case, the federal government would go in, arrest these folks for basically not doing what they needed to do, because they had this responsibility to the union, and the union was suffering. Therefore, the federal government would be able to go in, you know, as long as the federal government is abiding by and asking the states to abide by the Constitution, they're trapped. As a matter of fact, you really can't secede. Just remember, I've said this before. A state cannot secede from the enforcement of the Constitution. I mean, not enforcement of unconstitutional laws that the federal government has imposed upon you. If you prove that what the federal government is doing is unconstitutional, that gives you an wide open door to secede.
Right.
You can leave the union at that point.
Right.
And every state in the union today has a right to secede. But if we do that, then the Constitution will be gone. Because the only thing that is keeping that Constitution, you know, in its position right now is because there's plenty of states that still want that Constitution as their center of government.
Right.
And if we have states that actually take a stand and say, you know, we're not going to stick around if you're going to continue to violate it this way, then it only opens the door for the progressive states to say, finally, we can abandon the Constitution, because those states that have been clinging to their guns and everything else are gone. And at that point, they would conduct warfare against the states, because we would not be a part of the union, and it would be, you know, open season on, you know, these conservative or red states or what have you. So unless there, you got to remember, where's the majority of the population of America?
Well, the majority seems to be in population centers, large cities.
Now, let me be very specific. This is a standard that is throughout the world. 70 to 80% of the world population lives within 250 miles of the coastline. In other words, if you go to China, the majority of the people that live in China live along that coast.
Right.
If you go anywhere in Europe, I mean, 250 miles is a good distance, and it practically wraps all the way around Europe. So the majority of the people that live in Europe are usually right around those coastlines. Or, you know, if there's a river for, like, you know, Germany and so forth. But still, those are small countries. 250 miles easily encompasses that. What, you know, Europe is kind of a small continent. When you look at America, 250 miles is the Eastern Seaboard states.
Right.
And it, as you wrap around Florida, that would be all of Florida. That would be all of California, all of Washington and Oregon. The states in the interior, from the West Coast, from Idaho across to Ohio or what have you, where you'd hit that 250-mile marker, that's kind of the rural states.
Right.
And so when we look at the magnitude of the population, so the people really live closer to those seaboard states. So the states that are really rural are usually really red. It would cause a problem if all of the states in the center of America seceded. It would cause a problem, but doesn't mean that the federal government or these progressive states wouldn't want to come after. Because the whole point in going down this rat hole is that the president has the ability to enforce these laws. He can call for Congress. In our Constitution, he can call for Congress to federalize the militia and basically use the militia to go in and capture and bring to justice the political leaders of this state and, like you said, seize the assets, but actually put the state into conservatorship so that it can fulfill its duty and responsibility to the union in paying its fair share. Now, to be clear, you do not have to pay taxes on things that aren't enumerated. So when they come along and they say, you've got to pay taxes, folks, on, you know, the money we spent on education, housing, and urban development, on labor, all of these unconstitutional powers, we have a right to say you can't tax us for those things. And the only way we can do that is through petitions. the right of petition to, you know, the right of the people to petition government for the redress of grievances, that is the mechanism. So, anyway, we kind of wrapped up 15. Let's go into 16. Let's go ahead.
Okay.
Now, and this may be a long run-on sentence as well, it looks like.
Yes, it looks like it's going to be another long sentence, so okay. I'll take a few breaths here. And that the resources of any state, which may be negligent in furnishing her just proportion of the common experience of the Union, may in a reasonable time be applied. It is further agreed that if any state shall so neglect as aforesaid to pass laws in compliance with the said requisition, and to adopt measures to give the same full effect for the space of 10 months, and it shall then or afterwards be found that a majority of the states have passed such laws and adopted such measures, the United States and Congress assembled shall have power and authority to levy, assess, and collect all sums and duties with which any such state so neglecting to comply with the requisition may stand charged on the same by the laws and rules by which the last state tax next, preceding such requisition in such state, was levied, assessed, and collected, to apportion the sum so required to the towns or cities in such state, to order the sum so apportioned to be assessed by the assessors of such last state tax, and the said assessments to be committed to the collectors of the same last state tax to collect and to make return of such assessments and commitments to the Treasurer of the United States, who by himself or his deputy, when directed by Congress, shall have power to recover the monies of such collectors for the use of the United States in the same manner and under the same penalties as state taxes are recovered and collected by the treasurers of the respective states, and the several towns or counties respectively shall be responsible for the conduct of said assessors and collectors, and in such and in case there shall be any vacancy in any of said offices of assessors or collectors by death, removal, refusal to serve, resignation, or otherwise, then other fit persons shall be chosen to fill such vacancies in the usual manner in such town and country within 20 days, town or country within 20 days after notice of the assessment, and in case any towns or counties, any assessors, collectors, or sheriffs shall neglect or refuse to do their duty, Congress shall have the same rights and the powers to compel them to do the same, that the state may have an assessing and collecting state taxes. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. And so, okay, yeah. So there's one more paragraph. That is your first period.
Right.
So, okay, you can take a breath and then finish the...
I needed to take a breath.
Okay. All right.
And if any state by any legislative act shall prevent or delay the due collection of said sums, as aforesaid, Congress shall have power and authority to appoint assessors and collectors thereof and sheriffs to enforce the collections under the warrants of distress issued by the Treasurer of the United States. And if any further opposition shall be made to such collections by the state or the citizens thereof and their conduct not disapproved of by the state, such conduct on the part of the state shall be considered as an open violation of the federal compact.
There you go. Okay, so now we have, out of the two sentences you read there, pretty much, it's really clear that the federal government was going down this path of assessing values of property.
Correct.
This went away under the Constitution.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, because all they had to do was they just had to apportion whatever the tax was per person, not by property value.
Right.
And the states had this obligation to pay for that particular, you know, burden or direct tax, the duty that the federal government placed onto the states. So, I mean, I think it's kind of a interesting, because do you want the federal government to come in and tell you what the value is, you know, and to drive those things, something that could be easily subjective? Because, you know, when you assess value, you know, we try to make it, you know, even. We try to make it, you know, a fair deal. But that's all in perception. It's never right. based on the truth. So, okay. So let's go into the 17th article. And we've got a couple of blanks here, but this is a short one. So go ahead.
Okay. And any state which from time to time shall be found in her payments on any requisition in advance on an average of the payments made by the states shall be allowed an interest of blank percent per annum, and her said advanced sums or experience in this and the state which from time to time shall be found in arrear on the principals aforesaid shall be charged with an interest of blank percent per annum on the sums which she may be so in arrear. Now, I'm not sure I understand this one. At first, I got the idea that it was addressing the state's pay in advance, their assessments, but then it ends with may be so in arrear. Now, I may also just be having recovering from the shock of reading, you know, two sentences that were the size of several paragraphs.
Yeah, so the problem, the prevailing problem, was the states were not paying their fair share. As a matter of fact, they weren't, many of them weren't paying. But those states, there were some states that paid with, you know, inflated currency.
Ah, oh, that's right, because they had their own currencies.
That's right. And so, you know, when you give somebody a bill and they end up giving you something that's worth pennies on the dollar, but based on the face value of the bill, what the reason why a precious metal currency was critical, because it sustained its value. A 1 ounce of gold is, I mean, if you have more gold in circulation, then you bring the value down of the gold, but it is far more stable as far as value goes, especially because it's hard to develop. I mean, how much gold is out there? So when we look at gold, silver, or precious metals, mm-hmm. it is not as it can't fluctuate like paper can. I mean, hey, you know, shoot, we turned on the printing press a year ago and we forgot we had it on, and now we got all this paper money.
Right. Right.
You never have that problem with gold. You know, you can only dig out so much. Mm-hmm. And so once, this is one of the reasons why when they passed the Treasury Act of 1792, I think, it's in the digital currency petition. But when they created that act, they opened the door to let anybody basically turn in gold, and they would give them the value of that gold or silver in the equal value. In other words, a one for one. You gave them 3 ounces, they gave you three coins, 3 1-ounce coins.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, there was a, you know, an equity that instead of you having to worry about gold nuggets and dust, they converted that into the coin, and that's what you received. So now you had something that was recognizable, something based on a standard, 1 ounce standard. So anyway, so this was a real short one, and Article 18 is another short one, so go ahead with 18, because we got time for this.
Okay. In case it shall hereafter be found necessary by Congress to establish any new systems of revenue and to make any new regulations in the finances of the U.S. for a limited term not exceeding 15 years in their operation for supplying the common treasury with monies for defraying all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare, and such new systems or regulations shall be agreed to and adopted by the United States and Congress assembled, and afterwards be confirmed by the legislatures of 11 states. And in that proportion, when there shall be more than 13 states in the Union, the same shall become binding on all the states as fully as if the legislatures of all the states should confirm the same.
Okay. So, makes sense?
No.
Okay, so what they're trying to do is they're basically trying to say, and this incentivizes the federal government as well as the states to add new states to the union.
Right.
Why?
Because the states are what generates revenue.
That's right.
Tax territory.
That's right. So there's this duty that they place. And what are they doing to new states to join the union? The same shall become binding on all states, right? So in other words, whatever the proportion is, this when this new state comes in, they're going to have this laid on their lap. Okay, you owe us this money.
Yeah, but you know, in proportion, let's say, I would think the more states there are, the less the, well, I was going to say the less burden it is on all of the states individually. Does that make sense? Or does it? In other words, the more states that are sharing this.
Yes, it brings the, so that's right. So, but, and that's where the incentive is for the other states to say, yeah, let's bring more states in.
Right.
Because it lowers their burden. But that burden is shifted out, and bottom line, every state that joins the union will be basically slapped with this duty, and it'll be reapportioned and reapportioned and reapportioned. But, you know, there was an incentive for the federal government to be able to add more states to the union, because then it was going to be easier to share that burden and for the states to be able to pay for that federal government. And as they started engaging in managing the territory moving west, they realized that that actually cost them a pretty penny, because they had to deploy the cavalry out there to guard until the state became a state to where it would have its own militia.
Mm-hmm.
And then then the state was the transition of the cavalry to the state, and the state militia was, you know, one of the obvious things that the, you know, they did as the state became a state.
Okay.
And that, so, go ahead.
No, here's, you mentioned the term cavalry, which means this was the military of the territories, right?
Well, actually, when it became a state, it wasn't a territory anymore. It was a state, which means that it was supposed to form its own militia.
Correct. But that leads to my question, is that outside the militia and in the territory...
Paul, that's a great question. So, Paul, that's a really good question. Sorry, folks, we're having to cut Paul off. We kind of knew this was going to happen. We just weren't paying attention. So when we come back, I'll have Paul ask that question regarding the militia and states as they were joining the union, you know, in context to, you know, the taxes and so forth. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Jared Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.